from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago, this Thursday, the Supreme Judicial Court legalized gay marriage in Massachusetts. Soon after, same-sex couples tied the knot in San Francisco, in Oregon, in New York State. Advocates of gay marriage announced they were on a roll. This month, a new, quite different chapter in the battle over gay marriage. 2 weeks ago, voters in 11 states banned same-sex marriage, and President Bush has proposed a constitutional amendment prohibiting gay unions. Tonight on Point, backlash over gay marriage and how both sides are preparing for the unfinished fight ahead. Did you think a year ago that gay marriage was unstoppable? Were you surprised by the 11-state sweep of gay marriage bans on November 2nd? Or were you confident the backlash was coming? And what comes next? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Ann Cornblatt, national correspondent for the Boston Globe. She's been covering the political fallout from the battle over gay marriage. Ann, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure, thank you.
So we had real winners and losers on November 2nd, and the winners were pretty much in the anti-gay marriage camp. What can you tell us about the strategies? First of all, let's look at both sides, but let's begin with the Republicans and the kind of anti-same-sex marriage crowd. Where are they expecting to go next with this impetus, Ann?
Well, they're still celebrating their wins from 2 weeks ago. They had expected at least 10 out of 11 of the states that you mentioned to pass their same-sex marriage bans. They weren't sure about Oregon. In the end, Oregon did pass the ban at the state level. And in a number of these states, in particular Ohio, the Republicans, the Bush folks, would tell you that it was the ban in part that helped turn out Republicans, especially evangelical Christians, to the polls and further enhance Bush's lead in those states.
So the gay marriage issue is a winning issue for them on many fronts, they're saying.
On many, many fronts. What happens next for them, it does get a little trickier for them. They hope to have at least 15 new state ballot initiatives in the midterms in 2006. At the federal level, it's not so easy. They've made gains in both the House and the Senate, but not anywhere near enough to reach the two-thirds majority they would need for a constitutional amendment. So I fully expect them to bring it up and to push for it. It's a big issue for the conservative base, but there's almost nobody who thinks they can win.
But even if they can't get a federal constitutional amendment banning gay marriage, it's widely seen by Republicans as a terrific issue for them, a cudgel, a supreme wedge issue.
That's right. They refer to it as the new abortion. It turns out their base, it gets their base very fired up. And it's an issue that for now they don't think the Democrats have figured out how to talk about. They believe that especially in some of in a number of Senate races, about five or six, where it's fairly conservative states, battleground states, Democrats are up for re-election in 2006, they have the Democrats running scared because they, well, as John Kerry did, they say they oppose gay marriage. Many of them support civil unions. Republicans think that's a muddy enough issue that they can confuse voters and win it themselves.
But if they raise put the amendment, the federal amendment, on the table, that will force people in Congress to be voting, to be on the record, and then they'll take that, you're saying, out for the 2006 elections.
That's right. They did this. They did it certainly in 2004. John Kerry didn't show up for that vote. So it's hard to say exactly how it will affect others who are there for the vote, who can't avoid it, or need to, in fact, vote in favor of it if they're in especially conservative states and are afraid not to. But you're right. The hope is to force them on the record. There are many, I would say, on the other side of this, there are some advocates of gay rights who are still stung by what happened 2 weeks ago. But they also think that there is room for the Republicans to suffer a backlash here.
And how would that unfold?
Well, in their best-case scenario, in their minds, Senator Rick Santorum from Pennsylvania, who is a leading advocate of the federal constitutional ban, is up for re-election in 2006 in a state that went for John Kerry, and where they feel that they could there would be some voters who would be afraid of someone who is pushing this quite so strongly. So there is, they think, room for a backlash, and right now they're figuring out exactly how to handle it.
But for right now, it seems the Republicans are making the bigger case of overreach, and they're making it against the advocates of gay marriage.
They certainly are. Absolutely. You're right on that.
If that may be the case, if Republicans manage to, you know, work this issue, but not so far that they engender a backlash of their own, What's the strategy that you're hearing from Democrats for dealing with this and from gay marriage advocates for trying to push their issue in the years ahead?
They're trying to figure out the way to talk about it right now. They think that they failed in the communications war over the last year, that, in fact, they might have overreached. That was Barney Frank, of course, who said that, this would result in this kind of a backlash. They're talking about putting on state ballots initiatives that talk about rights for gay couples, that talk about visitation rights, for example, or you know, benefits sharing in the case of one partner or the other dying, things that most people, most couples, I mean, most voters say they agree with, far short of actual gay marriage, but initiatives that would be in favor of gay couples' rights.
And are they still looking to the courts to push this issue?
I think I would expect that less so. There are some court cases out there, but right now they're really looking at winning support. Having gotten some support from one court, at least, in Massachusetts, they want to get some support at the ballot boxes and even in the polls.
Anne, stick with us. We want to begin to hear from some of the actors in this drama, and it's quite a drama given where we were a year ago and where we are as we talk tonight. We're joined right now from New York City by Sean Cahill. He's director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute. He was a leader at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force's annual conference this past weekend in St. Louis. He's author of Same-Sex Marriage in the United States, Focus on the Facts. Sean Cahill, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Sean, how do you describe the arc of this last year? From a year ago, when we're just 2 days away now from the anniversary of the Massachusetts court ruling making same-sex marriage legal for the first time, to where we stand today, what's happened? How do you describe it?
Well, I think it's important to go back a few more years than that. And if we could go back 5 years, one of the, in addition to the losses that we suffered on Election Day, which Anne and you have just described, there was also a silver lining in the exit poll. 3 in 5 U.S. voters across the country said that they either supported marriage equality for same-sex couples or civil unions, which provide equal benefits at the level of state policy, but none of the federal benefits.
Right. So you're seeing movement, and conservatives are saying the same thing. They're saying homophobia is going down, but opposition to gay marriage is not.
Well, but I think what's critical from that data point of 60%, about 25% of American voters supporting marriage, 35% supporting civil unions, is that 5 years ago, no one had ever heard of civil unions because they didn't exist. Because Vermont, you know, the Vermont court ruling happened 5 years ago next month.
The one that made civil unions acceptable there.
Yeah, the one that led to civil unions, which give equal treatment at the level of state policy, but none of the federal protections that married couples get. But, you know, 5 years ago, no one had ever heard of this concept, and now 1 in 3 American voters thinks it's a good idea.
So we've got this.
I think that's progress. But we also believe that basic human rights should not be put up for a popular vote in a secret ballot. There's something fundamentally wrong about that. And James Madison warned, one of the authors of our Constitution and our political system, that majority rule can devolve into majority tyranny. And to protect against that, they created the Bill of Rights and an independent judiciary to review acts by legislatures and by the executive branch. And, you know, I think, sadly, what we saw 2 weeks ago was an act of majority tyranny in these 11 states. But I think there are a lot of basic rights, like freedom of the press, separation of church and state, the Miranda rights, the right not to testify against yourself in a court of law. Those are basic rights that are fundamental to our system, that if you put them up for a popular vote in a lot of states in this country, they wouldn't get majority support. That doesn't mean that they're not right and not critical to our basic political system.
Sean Cahill, that sounds like you're still looking to the courts to defend what you're advocating here, gay marriage, but what happened on November 2nd seemed like a pretty strong rebuke to that. I'm hearing other gay marriage advocates say, maybe we've leaned too hard on the courts. Maybe we've got to enter all the way into the fray for public opinion here and you accomplish what we want to accomplish at the ballot box.
Well, we want to do that, and we are doing that. And around the country in these 11 states where we lost, you know, we lost, but we still went and talked to voters. In Oregon, we talked to 250,000 voters in Oregon, and we identified 100,000 who stood with us on November 2nd. Or actually, they vote by mail, so they voted a little earlier than that. But we got 5,000 volunteers statewide, gay and straight, who were willing to walk around neighborhoods and talk to people about gay and lesbian couples, many of us who are raising children, and the legal protections we need if one of us gets sick or if there's a death. And the basic protections like bereavement leave, like hospital visitation rights, like second parent adoption, that married heterosexual couples take for granted. So we are engaging the public, and, you know, but my point is that there are many, I mean, if you put the rights of atheists and agnostics in this country up for a popular vote in a country where 80 or 90% of the population believes in God, believes in some sort of God, you might not get majority support for basic rights for atheists and agnostics. But does that mean it's right to take away basic rights from that group? No.
Yeah, Sean, we've got that argument, and we see the silver lining you're describing, which is a general growing acceptance indicated in the polls, the exit polls on Election Day, and yet, a pretty tough blow on November 2nd. You've just come from the big conference, Gay and Lesbian Conference in St. Louis. What was the mood there? What were you hearing from people about what they saw unfold at the polls?
Well, the consensus that we heard from people from around the country is that we need to turn our attention as a community and turn and focus our resources on building our infrastructure at the state and local level. There's been a lot of focus from our movement on Washington, particularly during the Clinton administration, where we had great hopes for what we might be able to accomplish with the most pro-gay presidential administration in history. And I think that the lesson people took from these losses, in addition to the basic one that basic rights should not be put up for a popular vote, is that we need to build up the infrastructure of our movement. And so that's what we're focused on. And as I said, in Oregon, you know, in addition to the number of voters that we talked to, they raised almost $3 million, the pro-gay forces in Oregon. In Kentucky, they raised about $500,000 and mobilized hundreds of volunteers who talked to thousands of voters. Similarly, in Michigan, not only did we, raise money and talk to voters, but we got AARP and the NAACP and the labor unions to stand with us. In Ohio, we got the Republican governor to speak out against the amendment. So there's a broad coalition, not just of gay people or people on the left, who see these amendments as a bad idea.
Ann Kornblut, let me turn to you here. You've been doing a lot of reporting on this. How do you see the challenge of bringing public opinion around, if that indeed is what's going to happen here? How big a challenge for the advocates of gay rights, looking at those votes on Election Day, how big a challenge bringing American public opinion into their corner to support the forward movement here, if that's what we're going to see?
Well, I think actually I agree. I think that the case has been somewhat overstated from Election Day. While all of these bans passed, certainly the exit polling suggested that there is a majority who support some form of rights, and that wasn't the question on the ballot, though. And so I think that at this point, like I said before, I think the focus is in a lot of ways it is a public relations struggle, and it's one of rhetoric as much as it is of substance to get the majority of people focusing on the substance of what's at stake here, to focus on the sort of human elements of it, and to not ask the question about do you support gay marriage, but to ask do you support equal rights for gay people, for partner rights, for benefit rights, and for that sort of thing.
But, of course, in the meantime, the Republicans, as you've reported, are going to put this in a way that defines it as marriage and makes it most difficult for people to deal with it politically. How do you hear Democratic Party leaders talking about this issue, Ann? Do they feel saddled with this? Are they trying to get away from it? They want to escape it? Are they, as a matter of principle, going to stick with it, whatever it may cost them at the polls?
Well, I hate to say this, but right now they've had so much to worry about. This is only sort of one of the many things that the actual Democratic Party leadership I've heard talking about. I've certainly heard some backpedaling in how they want to discuss it in the next election. They do feel that it hurt them in terms of turnout. But again, I don't think they are going to back away from it. I wouldn't expect to see Democrats suddenly abandoning their support of civil unions, for example. I think they are really worried about figuring out how to talk about it in a way that doesn't, frighten the political middle, which I think is what they are afraid they did 2 weeks ago in the election.
Sean, we've just got half a minute before a break here. How's the future horizon changed in your mind's eye? You must be hoping for gay marriage, maybe nationally someday. Is that now many decades in the future, if at all?
Well, it could be in a lot of parts of the country, but we do have marriage for same-sex couples in Massachusetts. And one silver lining was that all of the incumbent state legislators in Massachusetts who stood with the gay community and stood for equality back last winter when they were facing an anti-gay constitutional amendment that would have undercut the high court ruling, they were all reelected. And several who stood against equality several months ago were defeated by pro-gay challengers.
Sean Cahill and Kornblut, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're going to be hearing from opponents of gay marriage celebrating November 2nd. We're talking about a new chapter in the battle over gay marriage. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new chapter in the battle over gay marriage after the backlash of November 2nd. You can join the conversation tonight. Did you think a year ago that gay marriage was on a roll, that it was unstoppable? Is it stopped in its tracks now? Is it in retreat? And were you surprised by the 11-state sweep of bans on same-sex marriage in November 2nd polling? Or were you confident all along that the backlash was coming, that it was just a matter of time? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Sean Cahill, director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute, and from Washington by Ann Kornblut, national correspondent for the Boston Globe, and right now from New York by Maggie Gallagher, president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy. She worked with governors and legislators in states that recently passed gay marriage bans. Maggie Gallagher, good evening. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We've been talking with you for most of the last year, intermittently, Maggie, about this. There was a time when you and your crew seemed kind of rocked back on their heels, but no more. November 2nd must look like a real affirmation to you.
Well, I have to say, I'm sure that many people are pleased, and I'm pleased, but it really wasn't a surprise to us. Anyone who'd looked at what the American people think about this issue realized that, yes, the American people are much more tolerant and concerned about gay people, and that, yes, the vast majority of Americans do not see our common understanding of marriage as the union of husband and wife as a form of bigotry or a deprival of civil rights. So I guess the margin was a little higher. 75% of the electorate said they were opposed to same-sex marriage. And I think maybe what's new, and in the various states, I do think it's fairly amazing that in states as varied as Mississippi to Oregon, which is a blue state, a small state in which gay marriage advocates put a lot of money, they massed their forces there, and which has a history of voting down anti-gay referendum. Even there, the closest margin, it was 57% to 43%. So I would think, rather than celebrating or, you know, feeling rolled back or not rolled back, I would hope this would launch a serious conversation with maybe 75% of the American people are not bigots. Maybe there really is an important issue here with marriage and that we need to talk about it. On that, I would agree with Sean.
And in that conversation, Maggie Gallagher, for your group, for you, what are you looking for? Are you willing to maneuver toward civil unions with partnership rights?
Let me just tell you, I'm not a grassroots person and I don't do politics. I'm a think tank person. Mm-hmm. I've spent my whole career talking about marriage. So what I would hope would come out of this is a better, stronger, deeper understanding of why we have marriage as a social institution, how you need a social institution that, you know, that joins men and women in the kinds of sexual unions that don't end up producing fatherless children. And that there is a really danger in having courts redefine as a simple civil rights matter marriage, so that it's no longer about uniting mothers and fathers with their children. It's about, you know, adult agendas of various kinds. I think there are a lot of Americans who are pro-civil union and anti-same-sex marriage, and I think you will be hearing a lot more about that. And I think there will be, if you put hospital visitation rights on the ballot, I imagine you'd get overwhelming support for that. I don't see that as a problem. The question is, you know, what is marriage? Why do we have it? Why do we have laws about it? And are you a bigot? If you don't happen to agree with the latest idea that flashed on our scene, you know, like 2 years ago, like a rocket science, you know, like a rocket, and all of a sudden all the good people are supposed to line up and say, well, I guess there's no real problem here with redefining our most basic social institution for protecting children.
But I want to slice it a little finer than that, Maggie, about this issue of civil unions and whether your perception is that the consensus of anti-gay marriage groups is that civil unions, with the rights and privileges that generally come along with them, might indeed be extended to gay Americans, even if full traditional marriage status is not.
I think that if you're talking about the 75% of Americans who are opposed to gay marriage, I think that a good chunk of them would be fine with some kind of civil unions. However, I will tell you, one of the other things we learned is that if you put state constitutional amendments that define marriage as the union of husband and wife and limit marital benefits to opposite-sex couples, thus blocking civil unions, people still vote for them for overwhelming numbers. So I don't think that there is a kind of deep-seated commitment to that. I mean, I'm not sure what that civil union question means to people. I think it means that the American people, most people, would like to keep marriage, and they'd like to express some sort of tolerance and concern for the legitimate needs of gay and lesbian people, and I'm not sure it's really gotten down to this proposal or that proposal yet.
Sean Cahill, let me ask you, first, in the rejection of gay marriage in this number of states, does your group see bigotry? And secondly, is civil union an acceptable alternative for you?
Well, I don't know if there's bigotry involved. I think with some people there is, and I think with a lot of people there's not. I think a lot of people are basically decent people. But what's critical to correct is that in 8 of these 11 states, the amendments didn't just ban marriage. They threaten or ban any kind of partner recognition, not only for gay couples, but for unmarried straight couples as well. And what that means is that...
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, for unmarried opposite-sex couples, half of whom are raising kids. And I know you're against that, but
no,
I'm not.
I support that, yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
But the point is that there's now 2 million people in these 11 states who are either getting their benefits cut off, their health insurance coverage cut off, or are not going to be eligible for health insurance.
No, that's just frankly
that means,
not true.
Hang on a second, Maggie.
Hold on. And in Michigan, the American Family Association is interpreting the amendment to mean that at the University of Michigan in Michigan State, same-sex partners of employees of the university should not be getting domestic partner health coverage.
Sean, let us pick it up. Maggie Gallagher, how about it? Do you see this opposition to partner recognition in some of these bans as clearly as Sean does?
I just said a number. If you put it on the ballot that you're going to ban civil unions as well as gay marriage, in spite of what they tell pollsters, they still vote to define marriage as the union of husband and wife. That's the more important issue by far. Now, on the issue of that people are going to get their health insurance benefits taken away en masse, it's just not true. It is true that if you work for the government, for a university in a state like Michigan, yes, you probably will not be able to have health insurance benefits. And anyone who asks me, I am in favor of restricting these amendments to marriage alone. But it's not true that if you work for a private employer, if you have domestic partnerships through that, if you're a divorced or non-married couple and you're insuring each other's children, you know, if you're doing that now, you're still going to be able to do that. Health insurance is not a marital benefit per se.
But Maggie, let me ask you, you're saying opposition to gay marriage is not bigotry. Is opposition to the benefits of civil union partnership, is that bigotry to your mind?
No, I don't think so. I think it's its own separate debate, and, you know, some forms and versions of them I would support and some I wouldn't. I do think, I mean, I used to be more supportive of civil unions, but I have become convinced by advocates of gay marriage, people like Bill Eskridge of Yale and Andrew Sullivan, that civil unions are a way station, basically. The ball game is, you know, the normal rule is that private personal relationships are not regulated by law. And the one exception of an adult relationship is marriage. So of all the important relationships I have, the only one that the law gets involved in is marriage. And I think that the challenge, you know, the key to, there's no way to win this in the end without explaining why it is that marriage is worth this kind of special attention, which is not primarily benefits. I mean, I just want to warn, if there's any opposite sex or in Massachusetts same-sex couples thinking of getting married in order to get a whole pile, something that feels like a check from the government, you're going to be disappointed.
I'm not sure it's a check from the government that people have in mind. Ann Kornblatt, I know we just have you for another second. Help us in through these weeds. There's kind of disagreement here over exactly what was banned on November 2nd in a number of these state referendum. How much of the partner benefits have been chopped away?
I am going to take the fifth on this one because I've looked at this mostly from the political point of view. I will say that, you know, even just in the discussion we're having now, the phrase opposition to gay marriage versus the phrase the opposition to the benefits of domestic partnership, I think, puts into relief the political power of one versus the other. I think that, you know, it's very difficult to – I think it's going to be a lot harder for folks like Sean to make a powerful political point with the latter phrase, which doesn't have the same sort of ring and is not necessarily going to get their base out to vote in the way that the conservatives will get theirs out with the phrase opposition to gay marriage.
So domestic partnership doesn't not the same kind of rallying cry, and yet in some sense they both seem to be on the line here.
Well, it does seem like that, and of course each side will make the case to different degrees. Like I said, it's really a question of definition on both sides.
Ann Kornblatt, always great to have you.
Thanks so much
for your reporting. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Ann Kornblatt is national correspondent for the Boston Globe. Let's turn to our callers. Linda's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling compelling because as soon as I heard this topic, I just thought, this has suddenly affected me as a voter. I voted for the first time as a Democrat. I never did it before. I thought, you know, my vote's going to do it. This is going to be great. I find out, you know, the next day, whenever, that 11 states had this on the ballot and that people came out in droves. It seems to me that's what lost the election for the Democrats. And I, aside from the gay marriage issue, we're still, you know, like the red states and the blue states. And I feel like it really made a difference.
So what do you take away from that, Linda? Are you then saying the Democratic Party ought to back away from this issue or that it's a matter of principle that it stay with it? How do you see it?
Well, I think that you have to pick your fights. And I think that it's good now for people like Sean to get people educated. But I think you have to make sure people are educated to get the next step of voting in your favor. You know, if you expect too much of people too soon, they're do what they just did, which is vote against you. And I feel like as the Democratic Party should have, I don't know, I mean, who oversees these things, whether these things should have been included or not, you know?
Well, they kind of take on a life of their own at a certain point, don't they? And we saw that this year. But Linda, thank you very much for your call to respond.
Tom, can I respond to that?
Yeah, Sean Cahill.
Yeah, first of all, Kerry was not for gay marriage. He said it repeatedly.
Very explicitly, right?
Very explicitly. And his position was basically Bush's. Bush at the last minute came out and said he supported civil unions, which contradicted a lot of things he did earlier in the year, supporting the federal marriage amendment, which, as originally written, would have threatened civil unions and domestic partnership, supporting Marriage Protection Week a year ago, which was opposed to any kind of partner recognition for gay couples. But I want to talk about the claim that this cost Kerry the election. There were 11 states with these initiatives on the ballot. 8 of them go Republican almost every time, you know, Oklahoma, Mississippi, et cetera. The other 3 were battleground states, and Kerry won 2 of them, Oregon and Michigan, even though anti-marriage, anti-family amendments were on the ballot in Michigan and Oregon. And in Ohio, Kerry apparently lost and the amendment won, but Ohio went Republican 4 of the last 6 presidential elections. And Kerry actually increased his vote in Ohio by 22% over what Gore got in 2000 in Ohio. Bush increased his vote over what he got in 2000 by 19%. Kerry got 30,000 more additional votes over Gore's vote tally than Bush got over what he got 4 years ago.
So you want to say no way, no how this gay marriage issue cost John Kerry the election?
Not in terms of the electoral vote. I think it was a factor, but to blame the election on gay marriage, to blame Kerry's loss on gay marriage is way overstating the case.
I want to get one more voice in this conversation. From Evanston, Illinois, we're joined by Andrew Koppelman. He's professor of law and political science at Northwestern University School of Law, author of The Gay Rights Question in Contemporary American Law. Andrew Koppelman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
I wonder if you'll just, we'll get to the legal aspects of this, but I wonder if you'll just turn to this issue of the election for a moment and the role that the gay marriage issue played. You know, there's a storyline out there that says gay marriage, with the vote we saw, cost Kerry the election. What do you make of it?
I think that we can't ever know. Part of it is that the poll information that people have relied on, you have a large number of voters who said that they based their vote on moral values. But moral values could mean anything. It could mean Bush lying about the war, or they think that Kerry lied about his experiences in Vietnam, or it could be gay marriage, or it could be abortion. It's just very hard to tell. The other thing about this issue is because it touches people at such a basic level, I think that a lot of people just don't understand their own motivations here. So it's possible that same-sex marriage affected somebody's vote, and they're not going to tell you if a pollster asks them.
Now, you're a legal scholar. Where do you see this fight going? It's had its day in the courts and may again. Some of these referenda that have just been passed are being challenged. There's the question of the U.S. Supreme Court. But do you see this this fight as being largely played out in the Democratic, the voting arena, the ballot box, the legislatures, or in the courts?
I think from now on, I would hope that it's going to proceed to the legislatures rather than the courts. And my sense is that gay rights advocates understand this, that they have gotten what they can out of the courts. All that courts can really do is put issues on the agenda. courts can't impose social change on the country. Even Brown versus Board of Education, which is, I suppose, the best known example of a court bringing about social change, Brown came down in 1954 and didn't really have any effect on school segregation in the Deep South at all for about 10 years. It was only when the president and Congress got involved with the issue in the 1960s that you actually started to see change.
Maggie Gallagher, how about it? Do you think the courts will be backing out of this issue now, or do you expect more challenges there?
I expect the Supreme Court won't be creating same-sex marriage anytime soon, but I actually believe that the court strategy is going to be quite effective, and I think we're quite likely to see court-imposed same-sex marriage in California, in New Jersey, and possibly in New York and Washington, where there are ongoing cases. So it could quite easily be that 2 years from now, we'll have a third of the country under court-created gay marriage regimes. And I also believe there's some chance that a federal judge, a number of judges are being asked to overturn the state marriage amendment, so you may see judicial action in that way. And I do think, you know, the Pew organization, the Pew poll, just released an analysis of what voters meant by moral values. They went back and pulled up after the election. And it means, you know, 80% of these voters went for Bush and 20% went for Kerry. And it means, you know, 44% of them named a particular social issue, overwhelmingly gay marriage or abortion. 17% said traditional family values. And 18% said it meant something like God, the religion, the Bible. There is a sense, there's a strong vote, you know, block of voters who feel like other people are remaking their society along new values that are not their values, and that their voice is being delegitimized in the public square. And I think if the Democratic Party is seen as in any way cheerleading, you know, taking an issue that 75% of the Americans are opposed to and treating it as the new civil rights crusade, there are likely to be political consequences. You may admire their political courage, but there are likely to be political consequences.
Sean Cahill, I know we just got you for another minute here. Your colleague at the Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Matt Foreman, quoted saying, our legal strategy is at least 10 years ahead of our political and legislative strategy. Can you see that legislative strategy pulling abreast of the legal?
Well, I think that's the case in a lot of struggles. I mean, we wouldn't have legal contraception in this country if it weren't for Supreme Court rulings in the 60s and 70s. We wouldn't have the right to abortion in this country if it weren't for Roe v. Wade. And you could argue that those were ahead of legislative strategies. And getting back to this point about moral values, the LA Times asked in an exit poll, asked a similar close-ended question where moral values was one of the choices. And in 1996, 40% of respondents said they voted based on moral values. And in 2000, 35% said they voted for president based on moral values. That's a lot higher rate than this time around.
Numbers, numbers. And yet there are those bands. Sean Cahill, it's been great having you with us tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Sean Cahill, director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute. We are looking at a new chapter in the battle over gay marriage tonight. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new chapter in the battle over gay marriage after the backlash of November 2nd. You can join the conversation tonight. Did advocates of gay marriage push too far, too fast? Is the country anti-gay or just anti-gay marriage? And 100 years from now, will gay marriage be legal nationwide? Is this an inevitable civil right or an idea America will never wholly embrace? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Maggie Gallagher, president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy, joining us from New York. From Evanston, Illinois, we're joined by Andrew Koppelman at the Northwestern University School of Law. And right now from New York, we're joined by Andrew Sullivan, conservative columnist, posts columns at andrewsullivan.com, senior editor at The New Republic, editor of the book Same Sex Marriage Pro and Con. Andrew Sullivan, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So here you are, a well-known conservative, but also supporter of gay marriage. How do you interpret what's happened in the last month, Andrew?
You mean the election results in
the
various
states? Yes, please, yeah.
Well, I think that generally, you know, there is discomfort with the possibility of marriage rights being extended to gay people as well as straight people. And in many of the states where these things were put on the ballot, many rather socially conservative states, I think, were forced into a sort of panic mode and voted down things that weren't even being offered to them on the basis of a spurious notion that somehow marriages in Massachusetts would be automatically legal in other parts of the country, which for which there is no real constitutional or political history.
So as a conservative gay man, do you see this as bigotry or not?
I don't think you can be that crude about it. I think there are many, many, many different reasons for people to vote the way they did. Some people voted because they don't like the way it's been done through courts. Some voted thinking that they were supporting civil unions without realizing that many of those initiatives also banned civil unions. Some thought they were voting entirely on religious issues. Others thought they were voting for political matters. So I think it's a very complicated matter, and it would be foolish for any of us to generalize too broadly over what people were saying in those states.
Yet we've heard earlier in this hour that Republican strategists are eager to use this as a wedge issue, as a kind of cudgel to go after Democratic politicians. Do you see this as an effective wedge issue along the lines of race 30, 40 years ago, a sort of long-term value here in Republican hands?
Well, in some Republican hands. I mean, there are many Republicans who are not anti-gay and who do understand the need for gay relationships to have legal protections. The president himself said that he favors civil unions. 62% of all people who were polled in the exit poll said they favored either civil marriage or civil unions. So given the fact that we're only 6 months after this astonishing breakthrough in Massachusetts, it does strike me as really quite surprising that the response has not been greater than it actually was.
So overall, where do you see this trending, Andrew, to more acceptance?
There's no question it's trending towards more acceptance of gay people. I mean, I think you only have to look at the culture, even within the churches. I think that the demonization of gay people is not something that most people want to support or defend. And that's true even of those who are against equality in marriage. So that's the general trend, I think. If you look at the last 20, 30 years, it's been a revolution. I mean, the notion that somehow a setback in a handful of states that was deliberately ginned up by people for political reasons is somehow the death knell of this movement is absurd, I think. What happens now is that we have to make a better case. We have to engage people with the language of faith and responsibility and fidelity and commitment, all these values which are conservative values and family values, including gay people within their own families, to make the case to the conservative and moderate middle. We'll never go to get people who believe that gay people are going to hell and that any recognition of them is somehow sinful. That's not going to happen. But I'll remind you that the time in 1967 when interracial marriage was struck, the bans on it were struck down by the Supreme Court, the polling showed higher opposition to interracial marriage than the polls now show against gay marriage. So I think this is going to happen state by state. I think that many states are going to move. California in January is going to have civil unions that will be marriage in everything but name. New York may recognize Massachusetts marriages. We will have a federal and a federalist solution. And the only thing that matters is that we don't come to some peremptory and premature national decision through a national constitutional amendment. If we can avoid that event, then I think we'll figure this out state by state, year by year, decade by decade.
And at the moment, that national constitutional amendment appears, by all accounts, unlikely. Andrew Sullivan, I know we have to let you go, but thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Andrew Sullivan of AndrewSullivan.com and The New Republic. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Bob is calling from Leominster, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Yes. This is not a question of bigotry or prejudice. This is a question of natural law and the people in Middle America. On both coasts, say it's a natural law. Who cares whether they have a relationship? The thing is, you cannot force this as a marriage issue.
Bob, let me ask you. It sounds like you would vote against gay marriage, but would you vote for civil unions or domestic partnership rights so they could share insurance?
That's fine, but not marriage.
Just shy of marriage. Bob, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Let's get another call right here. Brandon is calling from High Point, North Carolina. Hi, Brandon. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. Thanks.
Great. Yeah, I guess I have three quick issues. One is first of all, you know, I agree with Sean earlier. You can't leave it up to the popular vote to vote for this sort of thing. I mean, I think we'd still have, you know, slavery in the South if that were the case. You know, this whole idea of family values, how are we supposed to develop any sense of tradition and family values if we can't, you know, we can't have an American tradition or a world tradition for that? And, you know, it really brings us into second-class citizenry. You know, I don't have the same equal rights, the same basic rights as somebody else does. You know, yet I have all the same tax responsibilities and other social responsibilities as any other American. Those are my issues.
Brendan, we've got it, and thanks very much for calling. Maggie Gallagher, let me turn to you. You hear a couple of things here from our callers. On the one side, saying this is against natural law, it's just common sense, and Americans responding to that. On the other side, Americans framing this as a civil rights issue, equating it with slavery, saying it's something eventually its time will come. How do you respond?
Well, yeah, I think what Andrew Sullivan and I and one of those last two callers agree with is that marriage is a separate issue. That, in fact, I mean, I agree with Andrew. I think that people are uncomfortable with demonizing gay and lesbian people and that they don't want to do that, and that the 75% of Americans who are opposed to marriage, all I wish is that even in shows like this, that we could take seriously that maybe these people aren't just backwards and uncomfortable or afraid. Maybe there really is something important and distinctive about marriage, that it serves important purposes, and it should not be kind of wrenched away from what it's for and made to serve, you know, this problem of how do we integrate gay and lesbian people into our society. So, I mean, I just fundamentally disagree with the last caller. I think that even if you're not married, if you're gay and lesbian, you ought to be able to have anyone you love visit you in a hospital. So if there's a problem with the way these systems are treating gay and lesbian people, let's deal with that. Let's not mess with marriage.
I have to say, Andrew Sullivan's pretty firmly on the record as favoring gay marriage, and yet we heard the nuance in what he said there. Andrew Koppelman, let me turn to you with this issue of gay marriage as a civil right. When you look at the history of how civil rights have taken hold in the United States, do you see this as one that is whose status as a civil right is inevitable or not?
I think that a lot of it depends on what happens in the larger culture. The general trend has been toward greater tolerance of gay relationships. And I think that the only thing that would prevent you from recognizing same-sex marriages, I think, in the long run, is a constitutional amendment. And the only thing that would produce a constitutional amendment is the scenario that Maggie just laid out before. If you had state Supreme Courts in New York and California and several others precipitately recognizing same-sex marriage and imposing that on states in short order, I think that the backlash would give you a constitutional.
But haven't we seen that already at the state level? You are seeing constitutional amendments. Isn't the state pushback
state
enough?
State constitutions and federal constitutions are very different. State constitutions get amended all the time. People don't particularly mind amending their state constitutions. There are some state constitutions that are as thick as the telephone book. It's generally regarded as a much more serious matter to amend the United States Constitution. That's why a constitutional amendment against same-sex marriage is not likely to pass right now, unless the political situation changes radically.
You know what I think it will take, Andrew? I agree with you, basically, that we are not yet at a political dynamic to pass a constitutional amendment. I think
Would you agree with me, Maggie, that it would be unfortunate if we got there?
No, I'm in favor of federal marriage amendment, and we could have that debate another night. But I don't see anything wrong with using the it's very difficult. You've got to get, you know, 2/3 vote in the House and in the Senate, and then you've got to get 3/5 of the state legislatures, and that's a very super democratic process. But I agree that with you that, it, you know, not only shouldn't it be done lightly, but it can't be done lightly. It can only be done if there's a very powerful sense that there's an important question that we need to settle and answer using the way our founders gave us to settle. What is it? Was it Madison who said certain questions of great national importance, which I know, Andrew, you and I disagree on whether marriage in the sense that I mean is one of them, but I really do. The only way you're going to get there, in my judgment, is a Democratic senator is going to have to lose his seat on this issue in 2006, at which point the political dynamics of getting it out to the state legislatures will be entirely different.
Well, there's a real chance of that from everything we read, Andrew Koppelman. Whether it's this issue or not, it could well be portrayed in that way. Do you see Democrats taking further losses and turning on this issue?
Well, I think that it depends on how the Democrats put it. I think that if I were a Democratic senator, I would say I'm opposed to the courts imposing same-sex marriage. I think that I would even say if the country is not ready for same-sex marriage, I'm not going to support it as a senator. But amending the U.S. Constitution is a major thing. You only do it if there is some urgent problem out there that needs to be solved.
That's not true. You know, we lowered the voting age to 18 because we thought it was a good idea, not because it was an urgent problem that needed to be solved. We can do this without a constitutional crisis if we think it's important enough. We're entitled to do it if we think this is an important question we'd like to settle in this way.
And yes, I guess there's no one who would say amending the U.S. Constitution is not a big deal. I want to get at least one more call in here. Peter's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks so much.
Sure.
I have the interesting situation of having a sort of second home in Canada, and I have a friend up there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to me to watch how differently Canada is treating this. And the provinces are gradually going along through the Canadian Constitution and through the courts.
And are they supporting gay marriage or opposing it?
They're supporting it. And the British Columbia is now on board, so is Ontario, Quebec, the Maritimes, and the Yukon, and as I understand it, Manitoba is slated to do the same.
And what's the tenor of the conversation there compared to what you're hearing tonight, Peter?
It gets louder at times. I mean, you have folks who do disagree with it, and one person simply said to me, I do disagree with it, but I do respect the court, and so on. And the legislature, undoubtedly, the parliament is probably going to follow along in January. But the other observations I would quickly make is that my hunch is that a great deal of this is going on in the states right now will be declared unconstitutional in terms of banning same-sex marriage. That's probably decades down the line, but I have a hunch on that.
Peter, let us pick that up because we're almost out of time. Andrew Koppelman, speak to that. Do you expect federal courts, the Supreme Court, to pick up these 11 bans? And if they do, what kind of consequence, what kind of result?
Thus far, not a single federal court has indicated that there is a problem under the federal constitution with refusing to recognize same-sex marriage. I would be astonished if any federal court would intervene in the internal processes of the states and tell them they can't have these amendments.
So you don't see that happening. And Maggie Gallagher, last word goes to you tonight. Have you won the battle?
No, not at all. In fact, I would agree with Sean that right now we're not on a track to win. Courts are extremely powerful, and I think that we're on a track to have a fragmented marriage system with our core and common understanding of marriage changed by a handful of judges in a handful of states. So it, in spite of the fact that what this election, you know, it is hopeful, it shows that the American people do care about this issue, and I think that's hard to deny. So it's really the future, in my view, is sort of unwritten yet, what will happen to marriage in this country.
A big conversation to unfold here and big moves in the last year. Maggie Gallagher, thanks a lot for being with us tonight. Maggie Gallagher, president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy, and Andrew Koppelman at Northwestern University Law School. Wonderful to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrew Koppelman, professor of law and political science, there, author of The Gay Rights Question in Contemporary American Law. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org, click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.